Good morning, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer session. This conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Trisha Yang. You may begin.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining today's TSM Version 6 Server Database call. I'm excited to have our speaker, Matt Anglin, presenting today. Matt is a veteran TSM server developer. He's been around since ADSM version 2, and he was part of the TSM DB2 switchover team, so he is very knowledgeable about the TSM server database using the DB2. This presentation that he'll be walking us through today was originally given at the TSM symposium, but there have been a lot of changes made and some new material added in. And it was so well received at the symposium that we were asked to present it as a Tivoli talk so we could get this great information out to a wider audience. Today's agenda is basically going to be Matt Anglin will be presenting for about the first 50 to 60 minutes, and then after that we will be opening it up for questions, and we've allocated plenty of time because we know there are lots of great questions out there, and Matt has a lot of good answers for everyone. So with that, let's go ahead and turn it over to Matt.
All right, thank you. This is Matt Anglin. As Trisha said, I've been in TSM server development for many years, primarily with deduplication the last couple of years, but also working with the TSM version 6 server database. I'm the author of the configuration and upgrade wizards that are used to set up a new database, and part of that requires extensive knowledge of how DB2 actually does its under the covers work. So this presentation was put together as kind of a planning presentation so that you can get a feel for what kind of disks you may need, additional CPU requirements that may be necessary, things like that. And I do a deep dive into the logs because the logs are very important, and it's a completely new log model for TSM. And so we want to make sure people understand the relationship between the various log directories and log files and avoiding that nasty situation of running out of the log. Because even though the log is much bigger, you can still run out of log and halt the server. So moving on to chart 2 with the agenda, I'm going to start with some current field status, getting a little bit of highlights on some flashes that we have and where we stand right now, you know, with having GA'd in March. Then I'm going to talk about the storage requirements for the new database and log, memory requirements, CPU requirements, and then user ID requirements. This is specifically related to the instance model that TSM now uses, similar to other products. I have a few things to say about upgrade considerations, and then, as I indicated earlier, a closer look at the database and log and exactly how those log files work. And then finally, we'll wrap it up with backing up the database. So proceeding to chart 4, the TSM 6.1 deployments are growing. We had initially expected a very slow adoption rate, but it's actually a little bit higher than we expected. It is less than the TSM 5.5 rate was when it first came out. But since we GA'd March 2009, we've had quite a few customers put TSM 6.1 into production. Some of the information that we're getting back from technical sales teams, support teams, and customers indicate that our field problems are pretty much in line with prior releases. The number of PMRs and APARs and such, when standardized to the number of customers we have, are pretty much on par with previous releases. So we're not seeing a whole lot of breakage, so to speak. There are a couple problems that were very serious that impacted a lot of customers, but we believe that we've addressed those. We've also discovered that customers are very anxious and hungry for information about the new database. You know, what's exactly going on underneath the database, how to configure it, things like that. In November this month, we issued a patch for 6.1.2.1. This particular level of maintenance has all the known problems, that all the major problems that we've found during the first, 6 months, 7 months that we've been GA. So it's very important that any customer rolling out TSM 6.1 apply this maintenance level. Okay, this is, like I said, this one has everything that we know of right now. We don't have a big backlog of nasty problems off on the side that we don't that we're aware of. So as of November 10th today, 6.1.2.1 is the recommended maintenance level for all customers. All right, we are excited about TSM 6.1's enhancements, and we remain focused on making sure that this product and the teams that use it are very successful. All right, moving on to storage requirements, chart 7. This is a picture of the TSM version 6 storage components. All right, on the left you have the TSM server. In the middle you have on the top TSM database, and then below that storage pools, whether they be disk, file, tape, whatever. And then on the right you have some various logs, an active log, a log mirror, an archive log, and a failover archive log. And we'll talk a little bit about each of these components. On chart 8, the TSM database is implemented via DB2. In TSM 6.1, that's DB2 version 9.5. The particular level shouldn't matter for the most part, but in case someone asks, it is DB2 9.5. The specification of the database is to TSM is a set of directories, okay? And DB2 is going to take the database containers and spread those containers across the directories. And it tries to maintain an equal distribution. So if you have, you know, one really large file system and a couple smaller ones, DB2 is still going to try to make each, the smaller ones may fill up first because he's going to try to keep about the same amount of data across each directory. The important thing with the database is to be generous in your size estimates. Plan for growth. If you underallocate, there's a good chance DB2 may need to reorganize the database. And even though this is done transparently, it can be time-consuming. DB2 reorgs they kind of churn and they generate a lot of log space, a lot of log records, and so you have to be careful about, you know, having those running all the time. It's not like we try to avoid them at all costs, but if you can avoid them with some planning, then that's the best way to go. In order to add space to DB2, you pretty much have one of two choices. You can either add a new directory, or you can make your existing directories larger. And our suggestion is that you start with many smaller directories and make them bigger as necessary. You know, kind of show you why in just a little bit. On to chart 9, the size estimates for version 6 is you need to assume between 600 and 1,000 bytes per object stored. Deduplication adds about 250 bytes per extent per storage pool. And so an extent in this case is a chunk or a piece of the file that's been deduplicated. All right, and if you know your average file size, which many people don't, the number of extents is approximately the average file size plus 256 kilobytes divided by 256 plus 1 times the number of files that you're storing in your server. So it's kind of, you know, if you can say, okay, I think my average file size is 3 meg, then you can plug it into this formula, assuming you know approximately how many millions of files you're storing, and get an estimate for how many additional bytes are necessary in the database. All right? And I have a little example there. If the average size is 2 megabytes, then we come up with 10 times the number of files, and that's the number of extents. Okay, so in this case, you then multiply the number of extents by the 250 bytes per extent per storage pool. So the calculations, which are primarily deduplication related, are based on an average extent or chunk size of 256 KB. Every file also has, in addition to all their data extents, has one metadata extent. And then files between 2K and 50K, period. And I understand it is difficult to determine an average file size across your storage pool. So the ability to actually predict how much space deduplication is going to take is probably nebulous. But this algorithm is if you can fill in the numbers, this algorithm will work. All right. Here's an example on chart 10 about a possible database layout with DB2 managing the various devices. So let's say you estimate you need 200 gigabytes for disk space. So you create four LUNs, each 50 gig assigned from a disk array. Each LUN is assigned its own volume group. Doesn't have to be. You can put them all into one volume group. But you want to make sure that each file system is dedicated to a particular LUN, or HDisk if you're AIX. So in one case, you would create, if you were to put all four of them in the same volume group, you would then create logical volumes, one per volume, and then put a file system in the logical volume. The important thing is that you want each directory that DB2 is using to go to its own disk so that there's no crossing between disks. All right, DB2 is going to use separate I/O threads for each directory, so by splitting the directories across your disk, you're going to maximize your throughput to the disk subsystem. Now let's take an example of extending the database. You want to add another 100 gigabytes to the database. All right. Option one is you assign LUNs 5 and 6, shown here as empty on the right. You the first four. You could put them in a volume group. You create the file systems, and then you assign them to TSM via TSM server command to add the directories to the database, and then poof, DB2 them. However, as I mentioned previously, DB2 wants to spread the data out across the disk as best it can. So if you extend your database in this fashion, you will almost certainly guarantee a DB2 reorganization. DB2 is going to want to take data from the first four volumes and spread them out across volumes 5 and 6. Okay, so it's certainly possible to extend your database this way, but may not necessarily be the desired way. Moving on to chart 12, there's another option, okay, and that is to extend your database by simply making each of your existing directories slightly bigger. So in this particular case, we create, instead of two 50-gig LUNs, we allocate four 25-gig LUNs. We add the individual LUNs, so in the bottom on the left you see LUN 1 and LUN 5, which together make 75 gig. You basically take LUN 5, you add it to the volume group for LUN 1, and you extend your file system to span both volumes. Okay? DB2 is still going to do the I.O. against four different directories, right? DB1/DB2/DB3/DB4. And there will be a little bit of I.O. optimization loss because you have two different disks there behind each of these volumes. But this avoids the reorganization, and it also doesn't require that you do anything to TSM in terms of defining new database spaces, right? All you have to do is make your directories bigger, and you have more database space. All right. Chart 13 shows a slightly different approach, which is probably, I don't know which one is more realistic, but this one has inside the disk array a number of smaller LUNs that are then conglomerated into a larger disk and assigned to the host. The previous example was individual disks just inside an array. Maybe they were RAID 1 for mirroring or you know, who knows what. It could have been RAID 5. It's just different ways of showing pretty much the same thing. Instead of having four LUNs, each 50 gig, this is just an example of having a single LUN that's 200 gig. The downside to this is that DB2 is only going to see the one disk, and he's not going to have as many I/O threads active because he doesn't think there's as much bandwidth on the channels. If you really have the bandwidth, moving on to chart 14, there is a parameter that you can issue, a command called DB2Set, that you can change the number of threads that DB2 uses. The initial default, when TSM shifts, this value is set to star, which tells DB2 to use 6 I/O threads per directory. Okay? And if you have a highly parallel channel behind a disk and you can handle more than that, then you can use this DB2 set command to increase the number of threads for DB2. And I'm not sure whether you need to restart TSM to make that active. That's an instance setting, and you may have to stop and restart the instance for it to take effect. All right, moving on to chart 15 is the TSM log directories. Log space is more complicated than with version 5. Instead of just the one log, we now have up to 4 logs. Two of them are required, and that's the active log directory. And that contains all your currently active transactions. And then you have your archive log directory. And those contain transactions required for database restore to the last backup point. Optionally, and I'll talk more about all these logs later. This is kind of just a high-level overview. Optional log directories are an active log mirror, which basically has the same size and characteristics as the active log. And then a failover archive log directory, which comes into play if your archive log directory isn't large enough. All log directories should be tuned for sequential I/O. They are written sequentially. And you really shouldn't have any log directory residing on the same disk or LAN as any other log directory. They all have very specific purposes, the active log being the most important from a TSM standpoint in terms of just running the server. The archive log becomes more important when you're trying to restore your database. Okay, log size estimates. The active log directory, I'm sorry, we're on chart 16. The active log directory must be large enough to hold all active transactions. You've heard about the old version 5 log pinning problem. Well, that log still exists because the log active log is a fixed. It can be much larger than version 5. It can be up to 128 gig. However, you still have a problem if you have one transaction that's pinning a log record that's, 100 gig ago, and you may run out of space unless that transaction is either committed or aborted. With the larger log size, hopefully that doesn't ever happen anymore, or much less likely to happen. But the active log directory has a 2 gig minimum with the suggestion that you start with at least twice the size of the version 5 log. I'm going to talk a little bit more about log sizing in a second. But the important thing about the active log is do not underestimate your active log directory. It's better to overestimate and then you can change it later. But because if the log fills up, if the active log fills up, okay, you can reduce your log size with a server restart if you overallocate. Okay, it changes to the options file and then a restart. The active log is the highest priority of any log directory and should be on its own dedicated LUN or disk. Every transaction that happens in the server gets written to the active log. So this is the most important log, the most active log, the highest priority log. The archive log directory must be large enough to hold all log files generated generally over the last 2 days. What that really means is over the last 2 full backups. So if you're doing a full backup once a day, then that would be 2 days. If you're doing a full backup once a week, then that would be 2 weeks. So we'll talk a little bit more about the archive log and its relationship to database backups in a little bit. During a full database backup, old archive log records are removed from the archive log directory. So that's one of the ways you keep your archive log directory from filling. The performance is not as critical for the archive log. Basically, these log records are not used anymore. They're during a database backup, they're stored with the database backup on tape, and during restore, they are used to roll the log forward. They are not used during active transactions at all. So it's not important that they be critically available or things like that. The mirror log onto chart 17 is really a clone of the active log. It's going to be the same size, and you're going to want it to be the same performance because now every transaction has to be written to both logs before things continue on, before the transaction can commit or abort. The failover archive log directory is a large secondary storage in case the archive log directory fills up. It's also used if the archive log directory is unavailable. Maybe the disk that the archive log directory is on is belly up and is no longer available, it's been buried offline, whatever, it'll go to the failover archive log directory. The failover archive log directory can be a directory in a shared file system, NFS, SIFS, primarily because you really don't want this directory used. It's more of a fail-safe than anything else. If this directory, the failover archive log directory, gets used frequently, then your archive log is too small, and you should tune your archive log, give it more space so that the failover isn't used. So it's a good way of telling whether your archive log is big enough for what you're doing. And again, database backup plays an important role in the archive logs. On chart 18, I have a link here to a tech doc that has that was recently published that has very specific and numerous examples of sizing your logs. So I didn't want to go into all the detail in this presentation, but if you are wondering just how big to make your log, check out this particular flash here. It's got some good information on various scenarios, large and small. But the bottom line, don't be, I don't want to use the word cheap, but be generous in your log allocations. In the grand scheme of things, 40 gig or 50 gig for log isn't all that much. I mean, I know it's a lot more than what version 5 may have required, but in reality, it's really not that much, and you're better off to give it plenty of log space so that you never have to worry about log problems. On charts 19 and 20, I'm not really going to talk about those. I included them here as an estimate for disk sizings. Leave it at that. There's some specific numbers on chart 20 for examples. So on to chart 22 then. Yeah, 22. Memory requirements. In version 5, the database buffer pool was the largest memory consumer in the server. Okay, we had I/O buffers and other things like that, but nothing storage required for the database buffer pool. And so however big you could make your buffer pool, the server performed that much better. But the TSM buffer pool was not always as efficient as it should have been, especially in certain Windows environments. The memory usage for that was within the DSM serve process, or DSM SVC if you're on Windows. For Linux and Unix, 1 to 2 gig was reasonable for a version 5 server. Of course, the more you could give it, the bigger your buffer pool could be, you know, and the better off you were. And on Windows, 1 gig was reasonable. But there were problems with non-paged pool memory in Windows 32-bit with our buffer pool. So some of the reason for moving to DB2 was to eliminate some of these restrictions with the buffer pool. On the chart 23, in version 6, the buffer pool still exists, but it's moved outside of the TSM process, and it's now managed by DB2. And in parentheses, you'll see DB2 SysC, DB2 SysCS. Those are the process names or programs that you will see either on Unix or Windows, which indicate DB2 running. We recommend 8 gig of RAM for a server on version 6. The DB2 buffer pool is larger, and it's much more efficient than the TSM buffer pool. And the database pages are now larger than they were in version 5. Okay, so 8 gig RAM recommended. I know I have a kind of a semi-production server running here in Tucson, and I give it about 10 gig right now. So and you have things like deduplication where your database is going to grow. The more RAM you can give it, the better off you'll be. DB2 uses IPC facilities, inter-process communications, shared memory regions, message queues, things like that. So while they don't necessarily require more RAM on the system, they are memory related, and there are limits on many Unix systems for these things. So you must make sure that you set your limits high enough to not impede DB2's ability to communicate. There's two processes generally in the server. On the Unix system, one is the server and the other is the DB2, or what we call the database manager. And these two processes communicate via IPC. Okay, on to chart 24, CPU requirements. This takes us to 25. The CPU requirements for version 6 are a little bit more than version 5. We don't have a quantitative number, but some things don't take as much CPU and other things take more. But overall, it's maybe 5 to 10% more CPU for the same function than version 5. Additional function that we added in version 6 does require more CPU, and these include primarily deduplication. The SHA-1 and the MD5 cryptographic functions are highly CPU intensive. They get analyzed. Both digests get run against all files that are deduplicated. So there's a lot of CPU requirements for that. And then multi-process exploration, which is new in version 6, is also a CPU burner because it does a lot of database queries. And really what you're doing is you're compressing the time it takes for exploration into a smaller time, and so the queries and deletions and things that are going on are done, you know, more in parallel. So it's not that the multi-process exploration is inherently more CPU intensive. It's simply that by running five of them at the same time, you're going to use five times as much CPU as you would have had you only been running one of them. All right? So those are two functions that can require more CPU in the server. There are internal functions that also require CPU time, DB reorganization and runstats, which are used to optimize our database lookups. These are background processes that you will see messages appearing on the server console every once in a while saying database reorganization has started, database reorganization is finished. They're usually done on a table-by-table basis. And then the run stats as well, and you'll see a table updating statistics message saying we're updating our statistics. With DB2, it's very important that the statistics on database access, how we're accessing the tables, be kept and updated so that the indices that DB2 uses can be optimized for our queries. So these functions are very important for performance reasons, but they do have CPU uses associated with them. All right, on to chart 27. The instance model. We've seen a couple problems in the field where people are trying to replicate the database using hardware replication, and then they go to their other system and nothing works. Part of that is because they're not replicating everything they need to, and it's important to know what a complete server is. What is an instance? We have supported in the past, and we support in version 6, running multiple instances on a system. They just each have to have their own database log, configuration files, and storage pools, right? You can run more than one server on a system. You always could, and it's a little bit easier in version 6. But what it relates to is this thing we call the instance model. All right? An instance is everything required to run a server. It's the database directories. It's the DB2 directory of the database directory. Which is kind of obscure, but it's part of the configuration stuff. It's the log files. It's your dsmserve.opt and your volume history and things like that, your instance directory, so to speak. And then it's your storage pool volumes, whether they're on disk or tape or whatever. Those things all together form an instance. In TSM version 6 and version 5, actually, each instance of the server requires its own directory. All right. Many people would always put their dsmserve.opt directly in user typically TSM server bin and run the server from there. And that is certainly not the in version 6. You should create your own directory, put your configuration files in there, and then simply run the server wherever it may be. Right? If it's in opt typically TSM server bin, Great. You run it there, but you run it from your instance directory. The dsmserve.dsk file is always located in the current working directory. And database and log files are usually stored somewhere else. They're usually on their own dedicated disk, either because of failover or other reasons, but you generally don't put them all together. Smaller shops may put them all together, and that's certainly okay if you understand the risk, but they need to be all. That's what an instance is. And as I mentioned, you can't have more than one instance per system. All right? On chart 28, for Unix specifically, each TSM instance requires a unique user ID. So if you're going to run three servers on one system, and by system that's either a standalone system, an LPAR, a virtual, a VMware system, a system image with one host name, okay, you can run multiple TSM servers on that host, but each individual server instance requires a unique user ID. You don't have to dedicate that user ID to just TSM, but each server instance has to have a different one. So it's probably not a bad idea to just go ahead and do that. One important thing is that it cannot be root. You cannot have a TSM instance owned by root. Okay, DB2 generally does not run as root. Each instance contains one TSM database. Okay, so you're going to have if you look at the bottom there, you're going to have a TSM instance equals a DB2 instance equals the instance user ID. So all three things are going to be the same. So if you have three servers, you could create a user ID TSM serve 1, and that's going to be the DB2 instance name, that's going to be the TSM instance name, and you're going to have a directory that has files owned by TSM serve 1 that are like dsmserve.opt and all the configuration files. If you want another server running on that system, you create another user ID, TSM serve 2. And that's going to be the DB2 instance name. That's going to be the TSM instance name. So it's a one-to-one relationship between TSM instance name and DB2 instance name, and that is the user ID that you're running. All right? This chart 29 is a little bit of talks a little bit about how the permissions work for these various things. In this particular example, it's important to know that the instance user ID controls the database access, not the user ID you're running the server as, but that TSM serve 1. That's the ID. That's the user ID that's going to write the database files, read the log files. Right? He's the one that's in charge of the database, not the server. The TSM server no longer directly accesses the database and logs. Okay, so even though the server may be running as root, it doesn't matter. Root is not the one that's writing the database and log files. It's the ID of the TSM/DB2 instance. Now, when you set up this user ID, in my example here, I said previously TSM serve 1, but on my chart 29 here, it's TSM user, so we'll switch over to TSM user in the example. In this particular case, you'll notice that TSM user has a UID of 203 and a group ID of 1, and he also belongs to the system and bin groups. The primary group of the user ID, in this case 1, is the what we call the sysadm group for the database instance. Okay, so in the example here, you have user ID, TSM user, user ID 203, group ID 1, staff. And down below, you'll see a DB2 get DBM config command, and it'll say sysadm group equals staff. Now, what that means is that any user that belongs to the group staff can start and stop this TSM instance. Okay? Any user. So if you had user Joe that happened to be a member of staff, well, Joe could come in and start and stop this particular TSM instance and perhaps drop the database, which, of course, would delete the whole thing. So you might want to create a separate group specifically for these users so that no other user can interfere with your particular TSM server database. In this particular example, if you look at user ID root, he belongs to groups 0, 2, 3, 7, and 8. Root, in this case, does not belong to group 1. So in this example, root is not authorized to start TSM, start this particular server instance. If you tried to start the server with user ID root using this instance user ID, it would fail. Root's not authorized. Okay? So just because you're root doesn't mean you have the keys to the kingdom as far as the server database goes. Chart 30 talks a little bit about the instance model on Windows. And the important thing to know here is that Windows has had this instance model for years. Okay, when you have DSM serve -k, and if you don't specify -k with a key, then the default is server 1. All right? So you can have multiple server instances on Windows. This is not new in version 6. The big difference between Windows and Unix for the TSM instance user IDs is that on Windows, all the TSM instances can share a single user ID. So in the example here, I have a TSM server key equals the DB2 instance name. On Unix, it was the instance name was the same as the user ID. On Windows, that's not true. The DB2 instance name is the server key, whether it's server 1, server 2, or whatever you may specify. When you set up that instance, set up that DB2 instance called server 1, you can use any user ID to run the service, but the name of the service is different. So that's a slight change between Windows and Unix. Windows actually has three distinct things, the DB2 instance name, the DB2 instance user ID, don't have to be the same, and on Unix they do. So on chart 31 now, we have pretty much the same picture we had earlier with some slightly different colors, so to speak. And what you'll see is that there's two boxes. One of them is the database manager, and that's in our example was TSM user. And in the other box to the lower left, you have TSM server. And this could be TSM user, could be root, administrator, could be any user ID that you want to run the server as. And the important thing here to recognize is that the TSM database and all four logs are written to and read from by the database manager, TSM user. They are not directly modified by the server. What the server is still doing, the server is still reading and writing configuration files, trace files, dev configs, volume histories, and the actual storage pools data, doing backups and stuff. But all database requests go through the inter-process communication to the database manager, and the database manager does the IOs to those particular disks. This is important to know when you're setting up your directories for your active logs and database files to recognize that the permissions on those directories must be writable by the instance user. It's not good enough that they're owned by root if you're running the server as root, because the server is not doing the I.O. to those devices. All right, on to chart 32. Here's a kind of what you'll see if you do like a PS command on a Unix system. You'll see the server, in this particular case, the server is running as root, PID number 328786. And then you'll see the database manager being run by TSM user, 246764. So this is one example where you can still run the server as root so that you can have root access to devices and stuff like that, but the database manager will never be running as root. Okay? In this particular example, DB2SysC is the main database manager process. If you have more than one server running on a system, you'll see more than one of these DB2SysCs. You'll see one for each currently running server. The DB2ACD is what we call the DB2 health monitor. And the other thing that this chart shows is that the server and the database manager communicate via shared memory and message queues. They don't use TCP/IP to talk to each other. It's all inter-process communication. On chart 33, then, you see more of a view of the services list from a Windows system, and you'll see here TSM Server 2. That Server 2 is the instance name, because that's the key name for this particular entry. And then on chart 34, you'll see the actual DB2 manager correlating to that server. So DB2-DB2-TSM1-Server2. The fact that that instance name is Server 2 matches the key name that the server is running, and that's how those two are tied together. All right. On chart 35, then, we'll talk a little bit about upgrade. Chart 36. Preparing for the upgrade. You want to make sure that you read the database upgrade utility README, okay? And you always want to make sure you get the latest version of the database upgrade utility. We make that available on the FTP site. It does not ship with the TSM version 6 product. I don't think it does anyway. So you should always go and get the absolute latest one from the FTP site so that you have the latest conversion stuff. What the upgrade is going to do is basically you're going to read all the data out of your version 5 database and insert it into version 6. Okay, it does not. There's a number of methods of doing that using either media or a network. To save some time, I sliced those out of this presentation, but we can schedule another presentation if we want to talk about more detailed upgrade stuff. So you're going to want to obtain the latest TSM version 6 DVD and get the latest upgrade utility, and then here are some references on upgrade tips, so to speak. Some of the restrictions with upgrading on chart 37 are that you cannot switch platforms using this upgrade method. All right, you cannot go from AIX to Solaris. You can't go from Windows to Linux. All right. What you can do is you can upgrade architectures on the same platform. So if you have Windows 32-bit x86 and you want to switch over to x64, we support that. If you have a version 5 Itanium 64 Windows, we support the conversion to the x64. For HP, the old PA RISC, if you have one of those and you want to upgrade to IA, you can. So, and then, of course, you can upgrade 32-bit to 64-bit on the same platform with the same endianness. All right? And by that, in particular, it's a reference to Solaris has a Spark, which is big endian, and they have their x86, which is little endian. So the endianness is different. You cannot convert from Spark to x86. You have to do some other mechanism to do that, either export or some other movement. You also cannot merge multiple version 5 databases during the upgrade. It's one-to-one. And you cannot alter the underlying DB2 settings. TSM has got an extensive schema defined that when you format a database, we put tons of constraints on the database. And if you go in there and start twiddling around with things, you're bound to mess up TSM. So even though it is possible for you to do this, you know, anyone skilled in DB2 could say, alter table, this, that, and the other, we do not support mucking with our particular schema of our database. So, all right. Now on chart 39, we're going to take another look at these logs. The active log directory, I call it non-circular. I think DB2 calls it circular, but it's a linear fixed-size log in a single directory. And as I mentioned, performance and availability are very important. When we write log files to the log directory, or when DB2 writes them, I should say, they are broken up into files of 512 megabytes. Okay. The archive log directory is basically a container for old active log files that are used during database restore. So when these 512 meg active log directories are no longer used, although that's not exactly true, they'll get moved to the archive log directory. The mirror log directory is, as I said, a mirror of the active log, so it has to be the same size. see. So how the logs flow. On to chart 40. Transactions, starts, and stops are written to the active log. Okay, any kind of recording of a transaction gets written to the active log. Once an active log file is full, even if it's still being used, if it is completely full, it is immediately copied to an archive log directory. Okay, if the archive log directory is not writable, then we try to, well, I keep saying we, DB2 tries to write it to the failover archive log. If the failover archive log directory is not writable, then the file is not copied. Okay? When an active log file has no more active transactions within it, it can be deleted. However, it cannot be deleted until it's archived. So even though I said when it's full, it's immediately copied, well, it's tried to be copied. If that copy is successful, then when it's eligible for deletion, the active log file will be deleted. But if for whatever reason it could not copy it to an archive log, then it cannot be deleted. On chart 41, there's a little more detail, a little bit of a picture. You have the active log at the top. We've got log files 99, 100, 101, and 102. You'll notice that transaction 1 is hanging out, was started in 99 and is still active. And 2, 3, and 4 were started in 100. Number 2 is still active. 3 got committed shortly after it was created, and then 4 got committed a little bit later. You also notice at the top of 99, 100, and 101, they say full. Once you cross from one log into the next, the previous log is full. And that's when it starts to get copied. So if you look at the archive log, you'll notice that it has a 98.log. That simply was the previous active log file that has been archived and no longer has any current transactions in it. So it has been deleted from the active log. 99 is full and was copied to the archive log directly below it. 100, once it got full, was copied to the archive log directory. And then at that time, the archive log directory became full. When 101 became full, it was copied to the, it was attempted to copy to the archive log, but since there was no space, it was copied to the failover archive log instead. Okay, so at this point, you have 99 through 102 are current active logs, even though 101 has no transactions that it started or ended, because it is in the middle of the oldest and the newest, it has to remain. So transaction 1, when it finally commits or aborts, since 99 has already been copied, then the 99 copy in the active log will be deleted. Okay? So the important thing to know is that log files are not moved. There is a time lag between when they are copied to the archive directory and when they are deleted. All right? These are subtleties that show up a lot in the field, and this chart is just meant to explain how it works so that when someone says, well, I don't get it because this doesn't look like it's supposed to be working this way, this is how they actually work. All right? You'll also notice that 102 is current, and so it is not archived at all. It's not done yet. Only when they are full do they get copied to the archive. Okay? All right, so on to chart 42, keeping the logs flowing. It's very important that the active log is large enough to contain all the active transactions. Watch out for those slow clients pinning the log. The log is much bigger now, and it may take a lot longer to pin it, but it can still happen. In TSM version 6, there's a lot more log activity than in version 5. Things like database reorganizations that run under the covers generate a ton of log records. So you may see your active and your archive logs growing tremendously, even though the server looks like it's not doing a single thing. And that's because DB2 maintenance is in progress under the covers, manipulating the database. And that will generate a lot of log records. So to keep the active log from failing, make sure the log's big enough and make sure the archive log directories have space. If you can't get the active log archived, it cannot be deleted. And it's very important that they be deleted when they're no longer necessary to make room for new ones. To keep the archive log directories from failing, perform regular full database backups. Only full database backups clear the archive log directories. Okay? Incremental database backups do not. So you may be saving a little bit of time doing an incremental database backup, but in effect you're going to cause your archive log directory to grow. And you'll see in a few charts here that it's not even clear that incremental database backup is beneficial over a full. The final point here is that it may take some time, but if any of the log directories become full, the server may halt. If the failover archive log directory is full and the archive log directory is full, then eventually the active log will fill up. Okay, it may take it a while, but it will. You have to make sure that the logs are vented. Okay, database maintenance tasks on chart 43. This just talks a little bit about the reorg and the run stats that happen. The reorganizations generally are performed when the CPU and I/O activity is low, and DB2 runs under the covers to optimize database tables for efficiency. You will see these two messages, 293i and 294i, indicating that reorganization has started and ended. And then run stats is used by DB2 to optimize our selects on the database, and you'll see the message ANR0136i when that particular thing is doing its business. Okay, last thing here on chart 45 then is backing up the database. The database backup is kind of interesting. We actually tell DB2 to back itself up to us, and then we store the data on our tapes much the same way we used to store our version 5 database backups. So what we do is we use the DB2's built-in support for TSM via the API. So when you install version 6, you also get the TSM client API installed, and that API is used by DB2 to connect back to the TSM and back itself up to us. Okay? We have a special node name for backup, the $_TSMDBMGR, and the password for this particular node name must be TSMDBMGR. This node is hidden, and you can't, if you do a query node, you won't see it, but you will see sessions starting with it, particular database backup sessions. And this particular node can only do database backups. You can't log in with this node and store data. Okay? The version 6 database backup and restore require volume history and dev config files, so you must make sure that you set those up in dsmserve.opt. And if possible, we advise that you use the instance configuration wizard if you're setting up a new instance, or the upgrade wizard, the instance upgrade wizard if you're upgrading, because those particular wizards do a lot of work under the covers to make sure that the database backup is configured. They set the password in the tsm.pwd file. They create all the entries in dsm.sys and dsm.opt. They change the DB2 parameters to point to everything that they've just created so that when you do the database backup, everything's all configured. If you don't use the wizards, the particular steps for setting it up are outlined in the installation guide, but the wizard is certainly recommended for this. On chart 46, then, is a flow of what happens during a database backup. The TSM server starts by initiating the database backup, which then goes to DB2, DB2 will then start sending the data back to the server. The server recognizes that it was a database backup coming from DB2, intercepts the data, and sends it out to our sequential data stream, either disk or tape, in much the same way the version 5 was done. They're not written to the storage pool volumes. They're written to other sequential volumes. And then finally, the volume history file is updated to indicate where we wrote the data, how many different volumes were used. Okay? chart 47 then, I'll talk about this briefly already, but there are two different types of database backups. There's the full backup, which backs up the entire database and all archive logs necessary to recover. If you're using a file device class for the database backup, it's going to store the archive logs on a separate volume than the database backup itself. But if you're using tape device classes, it appends the logs to the same volume that the database backup was written to. And then the other important thing about full backups, it prunes the archive log directories. If you continually see your archive log directory filling up 90%, 95%, a full database backup will help. An incremental backup backs up only the archive logs since the last database backup. The last full database backup. Okay, it doesn't actually back up the database, it just backs up more logs. And so this is why for incremental, not only does it not prune the archive logs, it actually backs up the same archive logs over and over and over again so that it can match it up with the database backup that you did with the full. So it does not prune the archive logs. On chart 48, then, you'll kind of see the difference between version 5 and version 6. Assuming they both started with a full, on Sunday, you had pretty much the same amount of data. Monday, maybe the same amount, Tuesday the same amount. But then as you look at Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the amount of data being backed up in version 6 with an incremental is almost approaching the size of a full. Okay. Now, these are hypothetical numbers, but the point is you might think that if I just do an incremental backup, I'll save the amount of data that I'm backing up. That may not be true. You may end up storing almost as much data as the database itself, plus you're also causing your archive log directory to remain very large, whereas a full database backup could shrink it a little bit. All right, so that's just a little bit of thing there. As far as if you can fit the database backup on a tape, I recommend full backups every day just to avoid the archive log issue. All right, on chart 49, then, I have a title page, important flashes. And on chart 50, I have three flashes, and 51, three more. As I mentioned previously, the 6121 patch is available and recommended for use by all customers. Strongly urge everyone to get on that patch. There are some very serious problems fixed in there, so by all means, get to there. And that's the flash 1408717, okay? The next flash is the 1389352. This one we've seen a lot of customers hit, and then really it's a server crash because the log's too small. And this is the one that has log sizing examples. So make sure, this is a plug to make sure they install 6121 because it addresses all these particular issues. All right. On the second page, then, is two flashes at the top, again, related to crashes in DB2. And then the last one is a flash that was just recently issued with has to do with deduplication. Move data, move no data with reconstruct equals no might cause some data integrity issues or data loss. So read up on all these flashes, but the bottom line is make sure you're current with 6121. All right, on chart 52, then, is what I call the bonus section. I'm not going to talk about it, but it's in the presentation. Different ways of going about the upgrade. If Tricia wants, I can have another call on upgrading and things to watch out for and stuff like that. But that's pretty much it for this presentation, and I'll open it up for questions.
Thank you so much, Matt. A lot of great information there. The operator will give you instructions on how to ask questions here. Also, just a reminder that this call was recorded, so if you do have any of your colleagues who'd like to listen to it, it will be posted out on the Tivoli Talk website.
Okay, thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be announced prior to asking the question. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, star 1 if you would like to ask a question. Adriana Pellegrini. You may ask your question.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, hi. A very good presentation, but and I would like to do some questions. Regarding the maintenance task on run stats and reorg, is that possible to control that frequency or stop and start that?
It's not possible in the sense that there are any externals to TSM to stop or start the run stats. The run stats are actually very important so that database performance is optimized. The reorganization generally only happens when the server's idle to begin with, okay? If the server's sitting there doing nothing, that's when DB2 recognizes it and will start doing reorganizations. So from that standpoint, it shouldn't matter. Reorgs shouldn't interfere much with general database, daily maintenance or workloads or things like that. The run stats, depending upon which table they're optimizing, may or may not run very quickly, but they, for the most part, just kind of run in the background when they need to. There is no mechanism to throttle those or control them at this time.
Okay, but TSM will do that automatically. I mean, it will understand when the CPU is low, and then you're going to start that. And what happens if it's something, let's say, it's running, and somebody, I have a lot of backups going, and then I have the CPU goes high. Does it stop the running of this?
Not at this time. If it becomes a problem, we'll look at that. We haven't seen any indication that is a problem. But if it does show as a problem, then we'll have to take a look at it.
Okay. Well, can I do more questions? Well, another question that I have here that my customers leave me. What happened when I have an active log that got full? I understand that the TSM will crash. How can we recover from that? Just increase the size of the active log?
Well, first of all, the server doesn't necessarily, well, some of the times it did crash, and that's what some of those flashes address. What the server is supposed to do is halt. Okay, there are very specific return codes we get back from DB2 when we try to update the database that it says, sorry, log's full. And we say, oh, that's no good, right? Generally speaking, there's two things, okay, one of two reasons that it's going to run out of log space. Either the log space is too small for the active workload, or your archive log directories are full, and it can't, DB2 cannot copy active logs to the archive logs. All right? Depending upon which situation you're in, and it's the only way to really tell is if you look at your archive log directory and see if that particular file system is full, that is probably the cause. If there's plenty of room in your archive log directory, then it probably halted because your active workload was too small for the log. Generally, recovery for the former, where the archive log directory is full, is to either make that a little bigger so that DB2 can then vent the old active logs to the archive log and make room for more active logs. Or you can set up a failover archive log directory. With the server down, that kind of requires direct DB2 manipulation, but it can be done. And in that case, again, what you're doing there is solving a problem where DB2 needed to archive some logs, but it couldn't because the archive log directories were full. So that's one scenario that could occur, and that's how you solve that, is make those archive logs bigger and then start the server again, and as part of the startup, it will make room in the log. If the active log itself just became full, when the server starts, it should recover from it because most of the transactions that were in flight will get rolled back, and whatever old transaction was pinning the log is going to get killed, and it will be able to roll the log forward and get to a stable state again.
Okay. I don't need to do like an extended log anymore like we have in the version 5 when I have a log pinned and I have to in the crash everything.
In order to extend the log, you go into the
on the OPT file and just
You go into dsmserve.op and change the parameter, and we compare it to the value stored in another file and say, oh, they want log bigger, and then we'll go to DB2. But generally, in the case of a halt because of log fall, it's best to try to restart the server, let the log clear itself, then shut it down again, and then change your parameters in dsmserve.op so that you're not, you know, mixing a recovery scenario with DB2 trying to move the log.
Okay.
Because you can also move the log directories by changing the, I forgot the name of the option in the options file. There's like an active log dir. If you change that directory, we detect that you changed it, and we will move the log.
All right.
So if you're allocating, you have no more room on a disk, you can also move the log to a newer disk with more space by simply changing the option in the options file and restarting the server.
Okay. One more question that I have here, and the last one. My customer asked me how TSM manages the DB2 logs and how it manages the amount of DB2 connections.
Amount of DB2 connections?
Yeah, how the TSM manages the amount of DB2 connections and logs, DB2 logs too.
Well, connections and logs aren't the same thing, so I'm not sure exactly. there's a log sizing flash in the presentation. So in terms of figuring out how big the logs file should be, read that. As far as how does TSM manage the logs, TSM does not manage the logs.
Not logs.
TSM, I assume you're talking database logs.
Database, yes, exactly. DB2 logs.
Right. There's a number of locks. TSM has its own transaction manager that it's always had, and most of the locking that TSM does within itself still uses that locking mechanism. The database itself has a combination of access. Some things that we, when we select from DB2, are done with what we call cursor stability, and some are done with uncommitted read, depending upon what we want to do. Cursor stability requires more locking because DB2 will only return rows that are committed, okay, as opposed to uncommitted read, which we may get back rows that we've inserted in other transactions that are not yet committed. The locking of DB2 is handled strictly by DB2. When we try to access a row, DB2 will generally lock the row so that if we turn around and update it, it knows that nothing has changed. We have a lot of select statements that we also use what we call, for read-only. So we can access tables. If we know we're not going to change them, we use read-only access to the tables, and that eliminates some of the DB2 locks. But the bottom line is DB2 locks what it needs to lock to guarantee database integrity, and there's nothing. TSM's control of that is really based on whether we use cursor stability or uncommitted read and whether or not we add the for read only on our select statements. So aside from that, TSM doesn't really manage or deal with the locks. As locks and deadlocks occur, we have code in the server to handle that and either redrive or try changing some columns and trying again. Okay, but you may see an occasional deadlock message come out. We've been working to get rid of those by handling them within the server.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Our next question comes from Edward Chang.
Yeah, actually, I have a couple of questions here. The first one is on the page 7, and I can see that mentioned in the menu, and we have the log mirror and the failover. Those two are the optional, but in a lot of customers, they just say, okay, how about we create a big file system? So I'm wondering if we need to do that. If everything is in the same file system and it's on the same LUN, so I don't think any reason we need to use that for the log mirroring or the failover archive log. Am I correct?
You are correct. The failover archive log is there in case the archive log can't fill or can't be written. If they're in the same file system, then if the archive log can't be written, the failover archive log can't be written either, generally speaking. So You're right. I mean, if it's all in one file system, then there's no point, right?
It, okay.
The just as an example, again, I like I said earlier, I have a server running here that we've had since version. I don't know what version it was. It was an old NetStore box, so I think that was version 3 or something. We've had a server running in TS in our development lab here for a while. I have a an archive log that's like 100 gig, and my secondary archive log is an NFS-mounted file system that has 2 terabytes of free space. Okay, so if my 100 gig runs out of archive log, I got 2 terabytes on NFS-mounted disk that if I really needed it, it was there, but I don't ever expect to ever use it. Okay, so that, to me, is kind of where your failover archive log would be most beneficial. You know, if you got a file server somewhere and it's got a ton of space, you know, mount it up, read write to your TSM server, create a separate subdirectory for it so that you're not interfering with anything else on that file system, and then you know you've got plenty of space and you should never have to worry about running out of archive log space. That's just a suggestion, example of what I do. So.
Okay. Okay. The next question is on the page 10 and 11. And I can see that you said DB2 has like the striping the IO between different lungs. And that comes up with the similar question. Even I have 4 lungs and I can use the AIX, that would be the OS level striping, or I have the choice to go for DB2 striping. But I feel that it looks like AIX striping or OS can do that, and that will give you more flexibility. And if you go for like the page 11, right, and now you have 4 DB directory, and now say, well, run out of space, I need to add 2 more, I feel that from what I tested, and if you need to change the database files layout, you need to back up the database and then recreate the instance and then restore database. So it seems to be an online or it's a flexible process for the TSM version 6.
If you want to reduce the number of directories or move your directories, you have to do a database backup and restore. You don't have to backup and restore just to add new directories.
What would be kind of command, is that the TSM command to add more directory, database directory, or is the DB2 command to do that?
It's a TSM command.
Oh, okay.
And then we just use the APIs to DB2 and say, hey, here's some more space. But there is no corresponding API to say, please take away this space. So once you allocate 5 directories or 6 directories to DB2, you're going to have at least 6 directories until you, the only way to get rid of them is to back up your database, delete the database, recreate it on fewer volumes, and then restore it.
So that means, if we need to add it, then
you can add it easily. You just can't take it away.
Okay.
The age-old problem, like JFS, right? You can add more space, but you know you can't ever take it away if you want it. JFS2 at least fixed that, but so it's the same thing. You can add more directories very easily, and DB2 will reorganize and move the data around. But you cannot easily remove directories.
Okay.
So that's why you should select the number of directories based on, you know, your performance criteria, and then make those directories as big as they need to be based on how much capacity you need.
Mm. Okay, that's good. And on the page 23, and you mentioned that 8 gigabyte RAM per instance or per server or per, you know, I'm not quite sure about the 8 gigabyte. If the customer needs to run 2 or 3 instances, then what would be the recommended RAM requirement?
That 8 gig RAM is per server instance. So if you're running 3 servers, you should have at least 24 gig of RAM.
Ooh.
Because, and then it's very important that you use an option in the options file called dbmem%. The way DB2 works is that we use automatic memory management. So we kind of set it up as though this server is the only server running on the system. And what DB2 will do is he'll look at the real RAM on the system and say, okay, they got 16 gig on this system. I'm going to make my buffer pool 14 gig. Okay. Well, now you got another server sitting right next to it, and he's doing the same thing. I got 16 gig on the system. I'm going to use 14 gig for my buffer pool. All right? And so if you have a whole bunch, well, if you have more than one server, they're each thinking they own all that RAM. And so if they both go to 14 gig, well, now you got 28 gig of virtual used on a 16 gig system, and you're going to start paging. So what you should do is tell, the way you set this up is in the DSM serve options file, there's a DB mem percent option, and if you have two servers, you set it at 50, saying, even though there's 16 gig of RAM, I only want you to think there's, you know, 50% of that. Your maximum use is 50% of that. And so that'll keep instance 1 at 8 gig, and then instance 2 at 8 gig, and then together you'll use the whole 16 gig.
Okay, so that could be a good one. A lot of customers, they have like the library manager instance doing nothing, so we need to change that value to be a smaller number.
Right.
We don't want to use all memory.
Right.
Okay. Okay. And one more question is on the page 39, and you say the active log, once it is full or the transition is done, and it will copy to archive log. But when you do the copy, that means there will be a lot of I/O. So, if, for example, during the nighttime, the nightly backup, there will be the TSM server need to swap the 512 mega archive log. Once it is full, then you need to do a lot of I/O. So it looks like the I/O performance or the requirement will be much higher than the older version.
Well, again, the archive logs, if they're tuned for sequential access, DB2, once an archive log is full, he'll come along with another thread in the background and start copying that at a lower priority off to the archive log. All right? And so at that point, it's strictly a, you know, the same as if you went to the command line and said copy, you know, this file to that directory. And since it's all sequential, it should just be able to read it. If VMM is in place, it should be able to do the prefetching and presumably should be able to do the copy fairly quickly. The how frequently this occurs is based on how much active data you're storing. 512 meg is not small, and it's not like this is going to happen every 5 minutes, right? I mean, you really have to look at your archive log growth during your backup window. So before the backup window, you say, okay, my archive logs, it has 10 gig in it. All right, now I do a complete backup cycle, and I check it. Well, okay, now I got 30 gig. All right, so that means during the backup cycle, that's 20 gig. Now, that's probably very high. I don't know. But that gives you a way of saying, okay, my workload generates approximately 20 gig of log, you know, at least last night it did, right? And so if you do this over a few days, you can gauge how much log requirements there are, and then you can say, okay, if there was 10 gig log written and there are 512 meg files, that means over the course of however many hours, 20 log files got copied to the archive log. Right? So you can do the math and you can figure out just how frequently it's occurring. But I don't think it's, you know, a 512 meg log file is pretty large.
Yeah.
So it's going to take a while to fill it up, even under heavy load.
Okay.
But keep in mind, it's not the size of the objects, it's the number of objects that generates log records, right? If you back up one file that's 20 gig, well, we still only have one record in the database to represent that 20 gig.
Yeah.
Back up 20 million files, each, you know, 100K, well, that's 20 million database records. So, again, it's not so much how much data, it's how many files, how many objects you're backing up. But there are ways you can kind of look at the archive log directory. Because the archive log directory is really, you know, as the active log fills, those files get copied. So you can kind of gauge from the archive log how much log activity is going on every day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. My last question is that a customer, they tried that and they have the 8 gigab database a week ago, and they didn't change too much or add a lot of clients, and now become 28 gig database. And I think they did a lot of testing, so it's a backup database and they restored it and backup and they restore a couple of times. And I don't know any reason that database size will grow up so quickly. And I believe the DB2 will do the reorg, and I was told that will run every day. And where can we find those information, what the size before and after reorg you change to whatever size? Can we find it in TSM activity log or it's inside of DB2?
Well, the reorganizations, as I mentioned, there's a specific message that gets issued when those occur. ANR 293i, 294i, so you can see when that occurs. DB2 doesn't necessarily go back and fill in empty pages like the TSM database used to do, right? When TSM was always pretty compact, and when you delete rows, we would immediately merge tables and keep things small. DB2 doesn't necessarily work that way, okay? It's not uncommon for the DB2 database to grow, and you think, well, there's probably a lot of space gas in the actual files that DB2 is writing so that inserts can occur later without causing reorganizations, okay? Again, DB2, you know, I wouldn't put too much worry in the fact that the database grew. What I would say is, plan for growth. There's a lot more information stored in DB2 than the TSM database. Our database was very simplistic, served a very specific purpose, but its limitations had been reached. And part of the switch over to DB2 means, yeah, you may need a little bit more disk for the database. I think on my sample server, I went from about 27 gig used. I think I am at 120 gig now. Okay, but I'm also running deduplication on a 10 terabyte file system or storage pool, so I have a lot more records that I'm storing. Without deduplication, I think I went from 27 to about 50 gig, all right, just after the conversion. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. If it continues to grow forever and it's like, my goodness, what's this thing doing, then maybe that's cause for concern. But DB2 doesn't necessarily pack things back down because that requires reorganizations, which are generally avoided. Okay.
Okay. And no way to initialize the reorg process on DB2?
I'm not aware of one. I never looked, truthfully. We just let DB2 do its thing. Right. I mean, DB2 is a database manager. It's been around for many years, and we trust it to manage itself.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Morley Calcindo.
Hey there.
Hi.
I was just looking through a few other presentations probably about a month ago. There was a comment in there about if you have backup sets currently in a 5.5 environment and you try to upgrade to 6.1, it'll fail.
Yeah, that was before 6.1.2. We didn't have backup set support in 6.1 until 6.1.2 because we had some very serious performance problems we were trying to work through.
Okay. So to
typically related to tables of contents. So those were all fixed in 6.1.2. We refreshed the media in 6.1.2 so that if you went and bought a 6.1.2 DVD or, you know, downloaded the 6.1.2 image and installed it, it would work.
Okay. So the 6.1.2 has all the...
Yeah.
It's basically your base code with all your licenses.
I believe... the one from Passport Advantage, I believe, has the license stuff in it. Not 100% sure of that, but I think so.
Good. I hope so, because that's what I'll have to use then. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Wilhelm Hillinger.
Yes, hello, Matt. This is Wilhelm here. I do have a question regarding the mirroring of the database, TSM database. Currently, it's not possible, as I found out. So should we currently rely on other possibilities like storage subsystem or LVM or similar to that? Or
Yeah, if you really require mirroring, there's a number of hardware or operating system or mechanisms for mirroring. I'm not 100% sure why DB2 doesn't mirror the database. I really don't know, but maybe they just say, well, let the hardware do it. So, and again, in my sample environment here, I originally started with a RAID 5 database. I switched it to a RAID 1, so I'm actually doing, I have four 256 gig disk pairs. So my database can grow up to a terabyte.
Okay. Are there any plans to implement this feature? I mean, the customers are used to have the database mirrored by TSM. So.
Yeah, I know they are. I don't see DB2 adding this, and so I would not expect us to offer anything. This is one of those things that the only solution that I'm aware of for the foreseeable future is hardware or operating system or LVM. You know,
okay.
Other underneath DB2 mechanism.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Serge Godet, you may ask your question.
Thank you. My question has just been addressed.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Lars Bernhard.
Yes. Do you have any recommendations regarding disk layout when using SVC, virtualizing of disks?
I missed part of the question. Do I have any suggestions using... Repeat that.
I'll try again. When using SVC storage virtualization, do you have any recommendations regarding disk layout? I mean, even though you get different LUNs, data may end up on the same physical disks.
Do I have any I'm not a big expert on laying out disk arrays. I'll admit, when I set up my system, I let my performance guy tell me. I said, what should I do? He said, do this. I said, okay. All I can say is that from a TSM/DB2 perspective, even though it's a lot of disk, I think we want to see at least four, for maximum performance, try to have at least four different DB2 directories or TSM database directories, each to its own either LUN, set of LUNs, whatever, so that you don't have conflicting I/O requests from, you know, along the different channels. Does that make any sense? So, I mean, you could set it up with 100 directories, which is probably overkill, or you could set it up with all your disk in one directory, which is probably not enough. And so what we're our kind of recommendation is to have at least four directories, each with its own dedicated I/O channel, whatever that means, whether it's its own fiber adapter or its own, or if they can share an adapter, but they have their own disks, whatever it takes. From a DB2 perspective, we'd like to see at least four different disks/directories. And probably up to 8, 10, 12 if you have a really large database. That's probably, you know, that's kind of unofficial, not a real valuable comment. I know that our performance group is working on a white paper, I believe, that talks about DB2 setup, but I'm not 100% sure of that either. So unfortunately, I can't really offer any specific guidelines for SVC, you know, layouts. But I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that have plenty of suggestions.
Okay, thank you.
Zoran Majdusnik.
Yes, hello. I have a question regarding backups, and specifically archive logs. As I see, this problem is just monitoring how much free space you have in your file system, and pretty much when it grows beyond some point, you would activate a full database backup. So do you plan to do something, maybe implement a new functionality to do that?
We originally, that was in version 6.1, automatic database backups, when the archive log directory started showing a certain percentage, kind of like database backup triggers. We ran into some problems with that in terms of some of the communications with DB2, and the biggest, we're still trying to figure out. I know it's on the radar screen. I just don't know when it's going to be addressed. All right. I know there's a group of, in San Jose that is looking at that. But that is a very important. The backup space, the backup trigger is very important, and I know that we're not going to just ignore it. But I don't have a specific timeline for when it'll be addressed. But yes, that's kind of what you suggested is pretty much how it would work. Once the archive log directory starts showing a certain percent full, we will kick in an automatic database backup.
Okay, so in some foreseeable future, we'll see that.
Yeah.
Probably.
I'm not sure exactly when, but I know it's being looked at.
Okay. And just a comment, maybe you have not touched if there are any changes in select statements.
The select statements that were in version 5. Unfortunately is the right word. We changed the table schema dramatically between version 5 and version 6. We got rid of a number of tables. We merged a number of tables. And to preserve compatibility with existing version 5 selects against things like the backup objects table, we actually created views and stuff that looked like the version 5 select so that you could select them from there. Things like select from occupancy, select from nodes, those all still work like they did in version 5 for the most. I'm not aware of any specific ones that don't, but there may be a few. You also have the ability to go outside of TSM into DB2 and do selects, and you'll see more data than you saw with the selects inside the server, but whether or not you can make sense of it, who knows?
It's not documented anyway.
Not documented, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question, please press star 1. Rosanna Salerno. Rosanna Salerno, your line is open. Please check your mute button.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, my phone was on mute. Well, first of all, thank you very much for the presentation. This is excellent material. This is something my customers are asking a lot on how to configure database and disk layout and, well, best practices on new installations. Can I share this presentation with my customers, or are any documentation like this ready for customers?
I don't know what the... Tricia, maybe I'll turn that over to you. I don't have any concern with sharing this information. There's nothing confidential in here, but I don't know if that was the intent, Tricia.
Yeah, as long as there's nothing confidential in there, that's fine. There's also some good tech notes that were pointed out throughout the presentation that you'll also want to point your customers to.
Okay, thank you. And one thing else. Regarding skills, well, when DB2 was presenting for TSM 6.6, we tell customers that they will not need DB2 skills or any, that it will be embedded in the product. But what do you think about that?
Well, that's still our goal, is that you don't need to hire someone to manage DB2. We work very hard with DB2 to make sure that we are kind of automatically handling DB2 the way it needs to be handled. There are some things that, you know, if you're a DB2 expert, we've had people say, well, you know, you'd be a lot better if you did this and this and this and this. And it's like, yeah, but that would require that in order to do that, people had to know more about how DB2 is set up. So we picked a lot of DB2 automated functions, you know, the system managed storage as opposed to having us try to manage the storage, relying on DB2's expertise in managing their own database. So there are going to be messages that appear on the console that have DB2 SQL codes, the ones that we're not expecting, and those will just have to, you know, our goal is to turn those into real TSM messages and say, well, this is what really happened, and here's how you fix that. So the goal still is that they not have to have any kind of DB2 administrator. Clearly, someone who knows a little bit about it can probably help troubleshoot some problems that may occur. But so far, we've not heard anyone complaining about not, you know, we don't know how to manage this thing because there's just too much stuff about DB2 that we need to know. I think we've done a pretty good job of hiding most of the DB2 intricacies within TSM. A couple things get surfaced here and there, but I think for the most part, we're staying true to our goal of not requiring anyone to have DBA knowledge to run TSM.
Great. Thank you.
King Boone, you may ask your question.
Okay, I have this question about TSM patching. What happens if the TSM patching fails? Is it possible for us to roll back those patchings? How should we recover from such failure?
I'm not sure. I missed the question. TSM caching?
Patching.
Patching. Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right. I was missing. All right. So repeat your question for me, please.
Okay, assuming we were doing TSM patching from 6.12 to 6.1.21,
uh-huh.
Assuming the patching process failed, how should we go about recovering from such failures?
If the patch application fails?
Well, yes, the patching process, yeah.
The standard, you know, everyone should be backing up the database before they apply any maintenance to TSM. All right, that's been the rule for many, many years, even version 3, 4, 5, whatever. Before you ever change the code level, you back up the server because it's possible, although we don't do it in every patch or release or fix pack, it's possible that we'll change the schema transparently under the covers on you or migrate data from one table to another that you don't necessarily know about or need to know about. Once that migration occurs, if you try to just restore the old code and, you know, it's not finding what it used to see, then there's going to be problems. So the rule is, and has always been, prior to doing any maintenance upgrade, you do a full database backup and save that aside, and then you apply your maintenance. If the new maintenance doesn't work as expected and you want to revert back, then you generally have to uninstall and then go back and reinstall the version that you had prior and then restore the database that you had saved. That's kind of the procedure for backing out fixes.
Mm. So there's no way to apply the patches in applied state these days?
There's no way to apply the patch what?
In applied state, because in AIX, we can actually apply fixes in applied state or committed state.
Yeah, the unfortunately, I know what you're, yeah, I understand your concern. The installation of version 6 is more complicated because we are now shipping DB2, we're shipping a number of other products that TSM is coordinating with, the global security kit, other things like that for SSL. As the reason that we have this new installer is so that we can handle all the you know, many tasks of installing TSM now. Unfortunately, the installer doesn't really have a option that says, do you want to just apply or do you want to commit? And primarily because for like DB2, they don't necessarily have such capabilities. So unless every of the subcomponents that we're installing offer them an apply slash commit capability, we can't really say, all right, we're going to apply it, but DB2 is going to commit anyway, so there's nothing we can do about that. You know, and it just becomes one of, you know, a lot of products that we're managing during the installation, and our ability to back all of them off isn't there. So we can't offer that in our installer. So unfortunately, no, we don't have an apply-only mode for the installation of the patch. It's pretty much a, you know, one-way direction. If you want to uninstall it, you have to, or if you want to revert back to a previous level, you have to uninstall it and then install the base again.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Adriana Pellegrini.
Hi. One thing regarding the raw device for DB and log files, do you know when it's going to be available?
I couldn't hear everything you were saying. It sounded like you were cutting out.
Okay. I'm asking regarding to use of a raw device for DB2 or database and log.
Oh, raw device.
Possible.
I doubt DB2 will support that.
I'm sorry?
I don't think they're interested in that particular mechanism.
Okay.
So, and since they can't support it, we can't support it. So,
okay.
Whatever change, you know, I don't know all of the DB2 plans. If DB2 was to offer support along raw logical volumes, then TSM might be able to support them with some work. But at this point, I don't think that's on their radar screen. I think there's enough flags that you can set on file systems and with I/O using direct I/O and stuff like that to kind of circumvent the virtual memory manager interference and get near our RLV performance without using RLVs. So my guess is that they probably are not going to go that route.
Okay. And my customer says that he has a DBA that has DB skills. So what would be my speech for them when the DBA says, okay, I want to do some performance change in DB2?
Well, as long as they're not changing the schema or any of the things that TSM relies upon, then, you know, if they want to adjust their channel path, if they want to adjust their disk subsystem, you know, they're certainly more than welcome to do that. There are, aside from the few performance things on the that I mentioned with the instance, the DB2 set, you know, if there's something specific that doesn't interfere with TSM's use of the application of the database, then, you know, that may be okay. I think our general support statement is that we don't support people playing around with our instances, period. So if you go in there and start tweaking instance variables or something and things don't work, then we're kind of stuck. So the rule for our instances is that you should only be changing things as directed by level 2 or service, and you're not free to make your own changes to instance or database settings. Disk settings and other things outside of our control, you're welcome to do whatever you need to make it faster. If they have specific recommendations for TSM, they're certainly welcome to feed those back through requirements. We can look at that for future releases.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And once again, it is star one for your question. At this time, I'm not showing any further questions.
Well, thank you, everybody, for taking the time today to listen to this Tivoli talk on the Tivoli Storage Manager version 6 database. Once again, this has been recorded, so if you do have colleagues who'd like to listen to it, it will be out on the Tivoli Talk section as well as out on the Partner World. We will have the replay posted shortly. Thanks again.